You are now listening or watching to Hello Hello Kopi Kumilo podcast episode What is the Meaning of Life? 42 with Zim Ahmadi, the writer behind Daily Cine Back in the Day and also the founder of Awful Track Records. On this episode, he talks about why he loves the music scene in Malaysia, why he thinks Malaysia has raw talents, and what's stopping us creatives in Malaysia from making it in the West. On this episode, we also featured Kasih Lia Izora, the vocalist of the band Senja.
Oh, welcome home, welcome home.
Hello, hello, Kopi Kumilo podcast, and today we have Zim Ahmadi.
Hello.
What is up, Ahmadi? Man?
I'm good.
This is a legend interview right here. You guys are looking at one.
I'm not a legend interviewer. People barely know me. What are you talking about, Milo?
I mean, we're looking to the future, man.
Right. I mean.
Yeah, for those listeners who don't know who you are, how would you describe yourself, bro?
Oh, my catch line on my music review show in Daily Cine is... peminat muzik tegar budak baru belajar.
Wow.
And that's always been my tagline every time people ask me.
Is there an acronym to it?
No, it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
The reason why is because I wanna talk about music. I'm a music enthusiast, but I also know that I'm still young in the industry, mm-hmm. in the scene, and I'm always happy to learn.
Okay.
And I wanna open up that possibility to other people, right. as well.
So how do you become the person that you are today, dude? Like, how are you so fascinated by other people's, the interviewer side of things, where you like to dive into other people's minds, in a way, right? How do you become yourself? What's your backstory, dude?
Okay, this is going to be a bit of a cliche Tumblr post, probably.
Okay.
But I think as a kid, I always took that whole, like... live as many lives as you can philosophy very seriously. I took it very seriously in the sense that that's why I started reading so many kinds of books. I played video games, I watched movies and listened to music, and I wanted to know everything, because it stemmed from this anxiety of just living one life, you know, like it's scary that all we get is this and then we die. So what I try to do is try and dampen that anxiety by living the lives of people through movies, music and books. And then later on, it became conversations, like you meet new friends, new people, and artists come into the mix because of my work for the past 2 years and interviewing celebrities or visual artists or musicians of all of all stripes and backgrounds, just became a passion. Right? It's a long journey. I wanted to do a lot of things as a kid, you know, because as a person who's anxious about living only one life, of course I went through that wanting to be an astronaut phase, wanting to be a lawyer, wanting to be a lecturer. But now I'm just really interested in exploring culture in all its sense, everywhere, especially locally as well. That's a big question, man. I don't know where to end, but I guess that should suffice for now.
Where did it begin, though? Like, where do you study? Like, where do you grow up?
So I grew up in PJ for most of my life, Kelantan Jaya, especially since I was 10. But I was brought up musically by my dad a lot of time, because he used to collect cassettes and CDs, and he was a big Bob Marley fan. And Pink Floyd and the metal band Dio as well. And then there was also my uncle who used to put this CD, I think, of a Def Leppard performance on TV. And they're all from Kemaman. So I'm very attached to my Terengganu roots anyway as well. I go there every year. And for a significant part of my childhood, I was there a lot more, because my dad was still settling in KL and such. So that was the first time I was exposed to music, right? And then it was also falling in love with his.tv and MTV and eventually MySpace music and all the music magazines that I started popping up, that I started stumbling upon, like Rolling Stone, NME, Junk was a great inspiration, especially when I went to boarding school. When I was in Sultan Alam Shah, which was my boarding school, I was a bit culture shocked, I guess, because I was raised in my first part of my teenage years, I was in Damansara Jaya, and in DJ it was 80% Chinese. So that's when, you know,
that was the one near Atria, right?
Yeah, that's the one near Atria, when Atria wasn't so fancy.
Yeah.
We had like a wholesale book convention. a wholesale book sale thing every week or so. Yeah, and then so when you're in a school with 80% Chinese, there's this tendency to speak in more English.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in SAS, it was all Malays, and some of them could speak English, but most of them is, you know, Malay speaking, and mm-hmm. you had to be fluent in that regard, right? And I was exposed to a lot of that background. That's when I realized that I wasn't really in tune with local music.
Okay.
Like, of course, we've all heard a few Hujan tracks. You've seen a few Pop Shavit music videos before, but I felt really out of touch, and my friends in SAS really, you know, got me into things like Malik and the Teh Tarik crew, things like more post rock stuff on the Malaysian side as well, and that really inspired me to explore more, because I realized my world was so small and I was so, like, I would say, Western influenced, which I grew to hate. Like, why do I care so much about the US and UK music scene when I barely knew about it, about what's happening here, like right in front of my doorsteps? So that's when I started trying to reshape myself from this guy who's inspired by Western media to exploring more non-Western media, not just Malaysia, but also Japanese music, Korean music, Indonesian music, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so the love for music has always been a natural thing. It was partaken you by your dad, right?
Yes.
And what would be the music that you grew up listening to?
Oh,
apart from the Beatles. I'm guessing Beatles are everyone's...
Not
Beatles?
No, actually, that's a big misconception. I think people would think, the Beatles, because that's usually the cliche music fan thing.
Yeah.
But I never grew up with the Beatles, right? Of course, everyone has probably grew up having heard Yesterday or like All You Need Is Love, the cliche Beatles songs, right? Or even Obladi Oblada. But my passion for music, like what I really grew up with, thanks to MTV and His.TV, was actually a lot of emo rock. Like Dashboard Confessional.
Green Day a little bit.
Green Day, yes. From American Idiot, and then you explore backwards, right? You explore like Dookie, Warning, and all those other albums beforehand. But then it was mostly Simple Plan, My Chemical Romance, Good Charlotte, and I was really into that. I was just like, this real music, right? Screw Britney Spears, screw Mariah Carey. But secretly, I also was a fan of that, I just didn't tell people because I felt like it was an embarrassment. I grew out of that already. But that was what I grew up with for most of my life. And then around the time I was Form 2, around the time I was 14, it was, I was part of that post-punk revival hype, like Arctic Monkeys, The Strokes, The Libertines, and that's when I became more and more British, I guess, because of that, or more and more American as well. A lot of those music influenced me. In fact, I think a lot of people don't know this about me, but even though, like, I love a lot of R&B and hip-hop now, my love for hip-hop and R&B is actually very late. Like, I bloom in terms of my rap puberty really late, because I just didn't find many role models that I could relate to in that scene, because I always perceived myself as someone who couldn't belong in any box, because I was that Malay guy who wasn't religious enough but wasn't liberal enough as well.
I feel you, man.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So like, but in terms of gender as well, because I realized that I'm not macho because I don't really play sports, but I'm not like flamboyant and feminine either. So like, my gay friends don't embrace me as much, I guess, last time when I was 14. So rock had those people who just said like, screw you, screw all these categories. So you had Kurt Cobain wearing a dress, Johnny Rotten with earrings from the Sex Pistols, and I didn't see that much in hip-hop. So I think my love for hip-hop developed later because of that. Like, I listened to Eminem, sure, I knew 50 Cent, grew up with it, but I didn't have heroes. Until recently, like Frank Ocean, people who have like an LGBT, who are part of the LGBT community, who also make music, or people who defy gender stereotypes, like Saint Vincent as well. Like those people in the rock scene became an inspiration to me. But in the R&B scene, there's Frank Ocean, there's Serpent with Feet, there's this guy, his name is Anita. Anita Frank, if I'm not mistaken. And he was the first rapper I heard rapping about how hard it was to be gay. This is before the age of like Macklemore and stuff like that. So then I realized, oh wow, like there are unique people in all genres. You know, why am I choosing
just one?
Yeah, just one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if I'm choosing just one, I'm not really living life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it feels like choosing one type of friend. Like in life, it's helpful to have so many friends, so many kinds of friends. There are people who are athletic, there are people who can help you fix a tire, there are people who can help you out creatively, right? You want to be able to expand your social circle so that you don't miss out.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel about music as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then you end up doing law, right, in UIA,
yes.
right? So,
yes.
How did that came about? How did that like decision became a reality, man? How did law came into the picture? Were you like always have been like a studious kind of person?
No. I don't know. I guess it depends on who you ask. I've never perceived myself as a studious kind of person. In fact, I always feel like I'm not working hard enough in whatever it is that I do. And it's also because I'm not a schedule guy. Mm. Like I it's really annoying for a lot of people, and it's annoying to me too. So no, I wasn't very studious, but I guess going to boarding school really helped me a lot, right? Like sometimes in ways that was very taxing and very overwhelming in terms of disciplining myself. And that's when I realized, you know what, like I can't convince my parents that I want to be a music writer or a musician or whatever, so might as well find a middle ground. So like I said before, I was really into books. Like I'm still into books, like, and that brought me into a lot of very weird philosophy treatises. So then I was just like, what is a subject that makes me critically think about the problems of the world but is still marketable as a degree? So law became that middle ground.
Yeah.
But law, especially learning law in Malaysia, I mean, maybe this is not the same experience for everyone. I realized law doesn't really let you do that much philosophizing. Yeah. It's still a lot of memorizing. It's still a lot of understanding like precedences. Yeah. It's called ratio, decedenda, and stuff like that. And I felt really limited. That's why I was so thankful I met people like Arif Hamizan, who is a playwright now and also an actor, who helped me find, I think, a creative community that I can talk to. Because he was also a huge like music fan. Like, you know, we bonded over Alex Turner from the Arctic Monkeys.
So he did the same. He was in the same course.
Yes, he was in the same course.
He's in UIA, yeah, law, yeah, as well.
He took law as well. Yeah, so we're all, yeah, we all came from that. And then there's also debating. Which helped me, which I started doing since high school. And I like the idea of having to critically deconstruct an idea, and also the idea of empathizing with views that you don't necessarily agree with, right? And what subject or what course would use debating as a skill the most was law, right? So I continued debating in university, but law became, I feel like, the subject that didn't stray too far away from what I was already doing. So that's how the switch happened. That's when I realized, oh dude, I'm so free, right? Like, crap, maybe this won't put food on the table, right? Because, you know, there's the struggling artist trope, but maybe I can do this enough and don't die, you know? Like, maybe I'll do law on the side. So I wanted to do that, you know, but it didn't work out because I realized that I really hated being in a law firm. Being the whip that I am, right? But then after that, it was just I got the Daily Sydney offer, and I started, you know, seeing so many creative people on Twitter that I really admired, and I started going to more press conferences and theater launches and album launches, and I was just like, I can do this full time, right? I just have to figure it out, right? I just have to figure out how to make rent and stuff like that, and that's when the switch became finalized. When I became the head writer first and then editor of the Daily Sydney.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you joined Daily Sydney. What was the day in your life like, man, as a head writer or whatsoever creative venture that you started off with, and then what did it became and grew into, man, as time passed by?
So when I entered the Daily Sydney, the previous editor, whose name is Derek, is someone I really respect. And he, I think, is so crucial for the theatre scene. Even if he doesn't like to admit it, because he was the one who covered so many kinds of theatre pieces, but also visual arts as well. Like, he was very into art galleries and art festivals. And it was a very interesting portal, because it was one of the few outlets that really called out like shows like Meletup, right? You know, like, is this really a festival for film, or is it just sensationalism and capitalism combined into this disgusting ball of so-called comedy, right? And I was just like, whoa, what is the Daily Sunny? This is so cool, right? So I joined it, but then he left, right? And he tutored me just a bit, like through email, because I never got to be under him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So when he was gone, I was already like the head writer. But from there, I think I developed Daily Sunny into more of a music thing. But I still reviewed theatre pieces, so did a lot of it. But because of my relationship with Tapau TV, sort of like the very early phases.
Even before Daily Sunny?
No, like in the first few months of Daily Sunny, it became like more music. Because I was into music, I realized that. And as much as theatre was also a passion that I wanted to uphold, it wasn't as fiery or as great as music was. But eventually Daily Sunny became a lot more music based, because I realized that a lot of people in music, unless you're one of the big indie heads, you know, like if you're Takara Suiko of the Nupin Solitude, or you know, people like JD Wong, who's a famous mixer and sound engineer, would know the Daily Sunny, right? So then eventually they did know the Daily Sunny. Like, people started sending me press releases from the emo scene, from the folk indie scene. I got to talk to Fikri Fazil from The Weeknd when he started his Bayangan and project. And that's when, like, I realized after Sembang Soda and all those things, like, okay, maybe Daily Sunny is becoming more and more of a music portal thing. But I always made sure not to neglect theater and film and whatnot. I did sufficiently enough, right? Even though, like, I felt that it wasn't satisfying. You know, I felt like I left too early, whatever. It was the place I found connections, and the place when I realized people do take, at least some people do take this seriously, and I can push this idea of reviewing to the masses, right? Or reviewing or constant news coverage to the masses. Especially now when you don't have that much music coverage anymore. When people are obsessed with virality and clicks and everything has to be a sensation, it's hard to even release news of an upcoming album of an artist people don't know.
Yeah.
Because you have to get clicks, right? So that's why I started the Awful Track record project, because I wanted to be that guy who just reviewed music regardless and just kept people updated and stuff like that. When other media, they can do their own thing, their own great thing. For example, like, I'm working with Masses too, and like, I'm working part time with them, and Masses has this thing with angles, right? Let's find an angle on an artist and then push an article. Yeah, they can do that. They can go the Vice route, right? Let me be the guy who just does things middle of the road, like probably boring in a way, but does things consistently, so that people are in tune with whatever that's going on.
I would say that kind of approach is more raw.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You get the zest, the gist of it, right?
Yes.
Not just the good side.
Right.
But almost everything. Right.
Yes. Yes. That's true. Yeah. And you want to be inclusive, because I feel like what I wanted, I tell this to all my friends and everyone who is interested in listening to me talk. I tell this to them, that the point of Awful Track Record is that at the end of the day, I want to duplicate the feeling that people get when they go to Kinokuniya, especially if you're a book lover. And when you go to Kinokuniya, you're like, whoa, I can never finish these books before I die. You know, there are so many books in the world. I want people to go to a music site and feel, wow, music is so big, dude. Like it's not just AJL, it's not just MTV, it's not just the Grammys. There are so many realms of musicians and music and artistry that you can explore whatever suits you, right? And I want that kind of freedom to exist within people when they go to a music site.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, or I'm just confused. Like, did Brompari start the listening?
Yes, Brompari started the listening.
So he is technically the CEO.
Yes, he's the CEO. That's why I kept using editor and not, because I'm not the CEO of the listening. Yeah, shit. Yeah. But yeah, Bron discovered it in 2013. His philosophy was that the same way I was disenfranchised by music, he was disenfranchised by film coverage.
Right.
He was like, why is it that whenever you Google a Malay celebrity's name,
you can't really find much.
You can't even find a profile.
Yeah.
Like, the top news are gossips. Right, like, you can't even find. It was so hard to find an actor's filmography list, even, because we don't have, like, no one's gonna edit IMDb for us, right? So that's when he started the listening. He wanted to profile films and filmmakers and actors in a better light. I guess 6 years down the line, a lot has changed, but that philosophy is still there, which is, we care more about the people that don't get represented or the things that don't get represented, especially in the arts. And that's why Bron started the Dili Senila. Yeah, I lost so many weekends. Which is not a bad thing because I was doing what I loved. Like I interviewed with my friend videographer Lukman, right? Farhan Akmal from Documenting Kuala. I think you interviewed him before this, I'm not sure. I think you interviewed Adam Zainal. Sorry, wrong person.
Yeah,
Farhan Akmal. And we I think we spent two days going around KL because we had to do we had to have a lot of B-rolls of like Petaling Street that people don't know about, right? Next to the River of Lives, Madu, while talking to Farhan about how it feels like to photograph like GE14, how it feels like to make photo blocks or photo collections of the untouchables in India, like that sort of stuff, right? One is researching. I mean, I'm sure you know this, right? Researching questions and storyboarding an interview already takes like more than 2 days, at least if you're doing minimal work, right? And then the weekend is for interviews as well. So like a lot of that happened, right? Not just with Farhan Akmal. So that's why weekends is not up for grabs lah. When it comes to free time, it's all just for work. So yeah.
How different does that come in play with your new startup, like Awful Track Records?
Well, because
do you get more free time, or is it more busy now, or more or less the same?
It's freer, but in a bad sense.
Yeah.
It's freer because we're starting out, so we don't have many clients yet, right? That's why I have time. For example, I mean, in order to make some extra income, right? I also teach debating at Guancheng, which is a Chinese school in Jalan Syed Putra, and also in an institution called Blue Bricks, where I teach public speaking and and debate to kids from the age of 12 to 17, right?
That is interesting.
So I have time for that,
yeah.
Right? But, you know, I love teaching, but it's like last time, 80% of my stuff used to be arts. Now it's teaching, and the other half is arts, right? And like, but I guess the advantage of that is that I have the freedom to mold my path.
Cool. What you've obviously interviewed many musicians and artists, like with Sembang Soda.
Yes.
What would be the most memorable interview you've had so far, man?
Oh, hands down, Lok, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Lok or Lok, whatever you want to pronounce his name as, but Lok, right? Like I was firstly intimidated, because I was a budak baru belajar, more literally back then, right? Like, who am I to interview people? And I had this whole impression about me that Faris must have told people like, look, that interview ni bukan interview sebarangan je. This is an actual interview that you get in depth into the music and stuff like that. This is not some random template borak kopitiam stuff. Like, this is really an interview, right? So when you have people like that talking about you, You're gonna do a lot of research, man. There was a lot of pressure. But then turns out, like, Lok was not intimidating at all. Like, he was very friendly. But also, we had a really rich conversation about what it means to have an identity in music, especially as a Malaysian. Like, what's so important about preserving traditional music? Like, why do you think innovation is crushed in the music industry because we are so obsessed with being traditional? Or is it the other way around? Like, being traditional actually causes innovation. And I remember one of the most interesting things that that happened in the interview was already, if you know Butterfingers, right? Of course you know about Lok and how he met Emmett and stuff like that, how he was first into Metallica, and his favorite album is one of his favorite albums is Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, because he loves John Frusciante, right? But the cool thing was that he brought his records and he showed it, and so it felt like I'm going through Lok's personal documents, you know what I mean? And including like this old P. Ramlee press, like a compilation of his hits.
Damn.
And then when I was trying to talk to him about, is there a Nusantara sound, or is that just a myth? You know, do people just say Nusantara sound to say like ethnic creative, for example? Like, but then he started saying, well, there's a lot of ways you can do it. Like, for example, in my album Jangan Puja Sampai Kecewa, I'm quoting him, like, there's some times like Ghazal influences in it, and he started like taking guitar like at the side of the couch, and then he started playing like this is the Ghazal timing signature, this is how it sounds like if it's a bit more like distorted and stuff like that. And I'm just like, damn, that was cool. That was cool seeing a person's creative process literally come to life in the middle of a conversation. But there were a lot of other artists I had really great conversations with as well. I think you would agree that as interviewers, the best thing is breaking that ice.
Yeah.
It's when the artist realizes that this is not an interview anymore. Yeah. Like, this is the friend, right? Like, making them feel that is hard.
Yeah.
But when you get it, it's satisfying.
Yeah, and then it's also like a formula, or it's like, because we are all humans at the end of the day, right? You, no matter what you say, you are an interviewer or you are the person being interviewed, we are all humans, and it's just a conversation between two human beings.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be intimidated about. There's no other press conference. There's no other like media covering us. You know, it's just us having conversations.
Yeah, so yeah.
Once you, the person being interviewed, realize that, yeah, then they'll be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm just like having a conversation right now. That's so true. It's all good.
That's true. But it's also momentum, right? Because like, I feel the hardest thing is not just talking to them as human beings, but talking to them as a friend, because if they realize, oh, this is not the guy that I can talk to about my deepest passion, your interview will be boring.
Yeah.
Right? Like, sure, they'll be comfortable with you, but like, you gotta know about what makes Pastor Light tick to make them talk about what makes them passionate. Like, because like, I can be friendly with a person and still ask them about, so what do you think, what was the origin of the name Pastor Light? What's your inspiration? You know, the cliche things, yeah, right? They will still answer, but are they having fun?
Because it's like it's boring, and they've been asked many, many times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They have like a template for the answer, right?
Yes, yes.
So how is Bron Pallier like in real life, man? I've always wondered.
He's nice. Like, I'm sorry, people say that a lot about actors. No, but he's nice. Like, he. I realized one of the lovelier things about Bron Pallier is that, firstly, he's a very intelligent man, of course. But like, he has this thing where when he talks, especially when he gets animated about something, even in a meeting, right, when he talks about a proposal, he likes to use objects around him as props, right? Because I don't know, maybe this is just my observation, but like, for example, he'll take a cigarette box or like a bottle, and then he'll just be like, okay, so let's say this is you, right? And this is what happens, right? So he loves to do that. So it's like seeing him being a filmmaker in everything that he does. Like, yeah, he always has to set piece everything, storyboard everything, which is really cool. And he's also very, I feel, understanding and accommodating as well. Like, knowing that, you know, I have a lot of jobs, even when I was in Delhi Cine, he was very flexible about that. But he's a very ambitious man. Right now, because Delhi Cine is under Pixar Play Production, which is his production house, and he does a lot of like accelerator programs in the works as well, like that involves, you know, trying to incentivize smaller businesses to start up, especially in the halal industry. Like, he does a lot of things in his mind, and he's always this chill dude. Like, but he never looks manic, which is, I think, a talent that he has as an actor and as a person. Definitely, yeah. He's cool. Bron Pallier is awesome.
What do you think would be the factor which is stopping us creatives from branching out to the Western side? Like, why are we not recognized there? You know, like, for the likes of Yuna, right? She actually had to pay her own rent and trying to go to LA and try to get a gig, try to get a record label to sign her.
Yeah.
With the rest of us who are actually, we have raw talent in Malaysia. What's stopping us from getting there? What's stopping us from having our own 88 Rising? You know, our own Rich Shiga from going to LA in a global sense.
I feel. I want to answer that with 3 points, right? Okay. So firstly is, I love people who market themselves to the West, right? Like, people like Yuna who worked hard. I respect those people. I admire them, because it requires a lot of blood, sweat, and tears over the years, especially when you're nobody to the West, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a necessity to go to the West anymore, right? I feel that... Wait, this will be recorded.
Interview.
Yes. It's an interview.
Anyway,
if you've seen that, that was Kase, lead singer of Sinja.
Yeah. Hey, what up?
She's a member of Pandora's. It's a girl group as well. Okay. Anyway. So, because right now, if you want to market your music outside, you don't have to go to the West. Like, the East is a rising music industry, like Indonesia, East Asia. I mean, 88 Rising is a proof of that, right? Like, you just have to look east, and there's a much livelier market here, especially because markets in the West are often really saturated as well, right? So no, you don't need to go to the West. So maybe that's not a goal we always have to reconsider. If you want to market outside, regional marketing is also another awesome thing to reach out for, like Siti Nurhaliza being famous in Indonesia,
yeah,
for example, like that sort of stuff. That if you're looking for bucks, that brings big bucks, but also that brings cool cultural integrity as well to your music, right? You don't need the Western stamp of approval to make good music.
But I guess the reason being to branch out to the West is you can capitalize on more listeners.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So once the US take it in, the whole world will sort of take it in.
Because,
well,
like it or not, the US is still a cultural superpower, right? Well, okay, so which goes on to my second point, right? I feel what's needed now is in Malaysia is more of like an acceptance of diversity that is not superficial. Because I feel like at this point, when we talk about diversity, we always talk about things like racial tolerance and you know, whenever it's like Independence Day, we'll have cool YouTube content on nasi lemak and stuff like that, right? But in terms of music, like, the diversity means also accepting the weird, right? Like, we are very scared of venturing out into the weird. Especially because if you look at AJL, as much as there's some level of production innovation and genre innovation, people still have this huge perception, and this is, I think, emboldened by judges as well, by people in the industry, that good singing is singing where you have to, you have strong pipes and you have to go to the highest pitch,
yeah,
and you have to, like, do so many falsettos.
Hit the right notes.
Hit the right notes when, yeah, like, you know, a lot of industries, even in the East, have already passed that. Like, good music can be anything as long as it hits the people, man. You know, like, as long as it expresses the zeitgeist of that era, right? So that is universal. Like, regardless of whether you speak English or speak Malay, if the industry and the listeners start to accept that there is more to music than just sounding nice, then I feel we'll be more prominent. Like, in especially in the Western world, right? Like, people who go to the West, even though people say Yuna is like pop R&B, right? They do that, like, the reason why they get accepted is also because their music is unique in a sense, that they have their own persona. Like, that Yuna has this hijabi R&B persona to her, which she capitalizes on, which is great, and she also makes bops, you know, like R&B tunes that are catchy to everyone. You need to have that kind of uniqueness to you, a sense of identity. But the third point is, before you develop that kind of diversity to be prominent to the West, you need to first connect people from different music scenes. Because right now, we in Malaysia, we don't have a huge market, right? Like, if you live in the US and the UK, you have every right to be niche, right? You want to have a punk zine, sure, go ahead, right? You want to have a rap zine or a rap collective and only cater to a certain kind of rap listeners. You can do that, right? But in Malaysia, you can, but you won't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, you need to be able to connect with people from different scenes. And I think, like, the people who do that the best are usually the people who succeed. Because the thing is, like, I feel this might be really ignorant or just a huge generalization, but I'm just saying, like, in the US, if you don't like punk, you probably have listened to punk and decided you hated it.
Yeah.
Right? But in Malaysia, if you don't like avant-garde music or experimental noise or punk or post-rock, you probably have not listened to it.
Yeah.
Because the media doesn't give it coverage.
Yeah.
Or the media gives it coverage once every season.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, like, because we haven't embraced that diversity of genre. We haven't embraced the weird. We haven't embraced the fact that maybe noise can be attractive. Maybe ugliness can be beauty, right? Like, that's why people scream. That's why people dress barai in grunge music. That's why people have weird art personas like Bjork, right? Because you want to shock people. We don't do that. Like, our idea of shock is somebody, you know, taking off their hijab, or like somebody showing off their nipples.
Yeah.
Like Faisal Tahir getting that controversy. That's so silly, right? We're so focused on that, we forgot to be weird in our music, which is to be weird in our gossip.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a sad thing. I think if you pass those 3 points, we'll get somewhere.
I guess from the audience perspective, we are far from that, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, but from the creative perspective, we can see there's a little bit of growth going on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the indie scene is definitely growing, right? Like, I celebrate the existence of bands like Iqbal M. Especially Iqbal M, because one is that Iqbal sings in Malay, right? So there's already like a whole demographic that can listen to his music. It's meaningful. But he also has a very non, like, conventional, in the sense of Malaysian indie, like, in the sense of Malaysian mainstream, math rock guitar vibes to his instrumentation, his production. Like stuff that it's not like cliche rock, right? But people resonate with because it's Iqbal. Like Iqbal sings with such with such a almost like a punk rock drawl, but his song has meaning. That is such a good, I feel, mixture. Like I feel at this point Iqbal M is such a great Frankenstein of so many influences that can break indie into mainstream. Like Devonopian Solitude, who has been around for quite a while, juga, but still Takahara gaining more and more traction, people who dare to be weird. Najwa, who originally started out as Najwa Mahiyadin, right? Like breaking from jazz pop into neo soul sounds, which is still pretty strange to the Malaysian ears, right? Those people are breaking into something new, and that's what's exciting about it, right? But it's gonna take some time. I mean, I know Iqbal M resonates to people, but I still feel that AJL would have a hard time with that.
AJL?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, if you want to think of AJL as like the benchmark of Malaysian mainstream music,
Malaysia,
yeah. But we're growing, dude. I'm optimistic. That's why I'm happy to be here. You know what I mean? I'm happy to write about stuff like this, right? You don't need to educate people to welcome weirdness. You don't need to take a degree on postmodernism, right? Like, for example, dude, you go to Indonesia, right? And then you look at the rural areas there, like in Jogja, like in rural Jogja, not city Jogja, or even like in places like Palembang, right? Those people, you have like dangdut that is raunchy and weird, where this one guy plays a synth, and it sounds like no other dangdut in the world. You have people playing with like folk and then adding electronic production to it that gets an audience at a folk festival. I just feel that there is no platform for people in the rural area to express themselves. The other problem is circuits, right? In places like Indonesia, you have people with... You have sort of like a fixed tour circuit around Indonesia. Like in Malaysia, you still have to contact each state for an organizer, and it's a really hard time. So that means like if you're a musician and you're growing bigger, you can travel all over Indonesia and spread your weirdness everywhere, right? Spread your unique persona everywhere. But in Malaysia, we don't have a circuit in Kelantan.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's why I love it when bands like Killer Calculator go to Kelantan and perform secret shows or whatever, right? Well, not secret shows, or not, I wouldn't have said this. but you know, underground shows, right? We don't even have a platform for that, right?
I mean, Indonesia is definitely way ahead of us, right?
But not just in terms of, I hate it people say, oh, Indonesians are just much more artistically enlightened. I'm just like, well, not really. Like, firstly, they have a venue, and they still have people who hate on music they don't understand, right? We don't have to make everyone love Iqbal M. We just need to give Iqbal M enough platform so that there's a fan in every state. You know what I mean? Or there are fans in every state. Like, even the connection between Borneo and Semenanjung is so hard.
You know, pass the mic to her. Might as well. Come on in.
Okay. Kasih is in the podcast now.
This is Kasih. Hi, guys.
I'm just gonna make a quick point. So when we talk about the local music industry, there's actually such a huge gap between what's happening in Peninsula and in Borneo, because when we talk about the local indie scene, there's not enough coverage on what's happening in Sabah and Sarawak. The only band I know of that's been here, and this might sound very shallow even for me, but it's South China Sea, and they're from Kuching, I think. They're based in Kuching.
Let's not forget K-Click, Sabah and Hip Hop Collective.
Yeah.
Shout out to you guys.
That was Kase. Wait, what I wanted to say, wait, my point was that you have some really cool organizers bringing in music from Borneo, right? But it's just, you can't do that all the time. And I don't think it's as efficient as having a proper tour circuit that people can go through.
But there are many talents coming from the Borneo, right?
Yeah, there's an increasing number of talents.
Sasha Inkan,
as well, a songwriter, R&B artist, So, I just feel having infrastructure is actually much more important than education, right? Because infrastructure doesn't require the world to be converted, right? Infrastructure just requires the bare minimum so that people have a platform to expose their creative output, whether it's music, visual arts, or film, even, right? Festivals are doing that. Venue organizers are doing that. But not, it's not as active or not as connected as it is in Indonesia, maybe. Yeah. But yeah, no, like I don't have to wait for people in Terengganu to accept post rock. You know what I mean? Like, just perform.
Do you think there'll be a time where Malaysia could break in into the global scene? When I say global, through America, through the whole world. Do you think it will ever be a time where we surpass what Yuna has achieved now?
Wow.
I feel like the reason why Yuna has her success, right, is because, I mean, her first was the first album EP was called Decorate.
Yeah, Decorate, yeah.
Decorate. Mm-hmm. And then the one after or before that was the Rocket. And this might, I mean, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the reason why, it's the reason why, She won an award for her album Chapters recently.
Okay.
For Neo Soul. And I feel like the reason why was because she has adapted her sound to an American audience. Mm. So you see, like, I feel like a better example of someone who's broken into the international scene would be Ziavi.
Okay.
Without, not compromising.
Right. Okay, I get what you mean.
But she still keeps her identity as a proud Bornean, and she has all her.
So in a way, Yuna changed her sound to fit in the mess. That's what you're saying.
Not change. She
alter.
Adapt.
Adapt. Okay.
Yeah. Because you see, like, when she brought in Usher and, you know, like, her, there's one song I really like on the Chapters album, but even the music videos are, I mean, not saying that matters, but what I'm saying is that, you know, she clearly understands that in order for her to flourish overseas, that means she has to appeal to masses that can understand her. Maybe through the likes of, like, Erykah Badu and, like, all these people who are women of color, and Yuna knows that, knows that experience. And because, I'm not saying Americans are white people, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, in order for you to still break into the American market, you still need to appeal to different sorts of people.
Yeah.
Wait, can I just say again? This is why I don't. Also, being in the West means more listeners, right? Yeah. I feel like, one is more listeners doesn't necessarily mean that you have to compromise your integrity, right? Your identity. Ziavi is a good example as well. But also, you look at 88 Rising and how they market themselves, and how the Higher Brothers didn't have to stop learning Mandarin or rapping in Mandarin in order to do that, right? But it's about branding, man. It was about showing to people what exactly is so crazy about you that you're gonna do it, right? Like Higher Brothers is this, they're very jovial, they're fun, they're playful, their music video has really cool visuals, and that sort of thing is what sells music to a wider audience. But secondly, right, this is why I felt that going to the West doesn't have to be an objective for the industry, right? Like, because there's a lot found in Malay language translated into music that can never be understood, I feel, by the West. Like, that, because it's our identity, right? That's why I felt there's also the regional option of, like, including expanding yourself to a more universal sound, but not compromising your Malay or not compromising your identity. So there are many options for you to do that. But even then, you need branding, because you need to be much more unique than let's say 420 in Indonesia, right? Or like bands like Dewa 19, because they already have their Dewa 19. What's our Dewa 19, right? Like, how do you break into that scene?
So it's important to actually have your own identity rather than just a replicate of other people's success.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of, like, for example, the rappers coming out who's doing the exact same thing of a success story that Rich Sugar had done. People are just trying to copy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a train, I feel. Like, if one guy starts it, other people will follow, right? And these people would sometimes succeed, right? Because sometimes duplication works, because people are like, oh, hey, this guy sounds like another rapper I like Rich Brian, for example. Like, might as well listen to the rest of his discography.
But
right?
Maybe, I guess, if you are inspired by them, you have a little bit elements of it's fine.
But the hype train doesn't last.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you cannot be the 100th Rich Brian.
Yeah.
You can be the 5th Rich Brian, but if you're the 100th garbage, right? It's dead, man. Yeah. Be someone else, you know? And people have to read that. People have to understand what the audience is. And as much as you people like, people say, like, maybe Yuna is still cliche R&B in comparison to all the other US R&B artists that do stuff, like, the fact is Yuna knows her audience, right? She reads, and she adapts to it, and she reads the audience well, and that's why she makes the music that she makes now, you know?
I think branding is so important because if you think about it... I think branding is so important because actually the reality is that 88 Rising isn't the first Asian collective to ever exist. I think they're the first to break into the international market, and they've expanded just beyond Asian acts. And now, sorry, I'm thinking about 7-7. Sorry, but yeah, I feel like branding is so important because, like, you see, what is so admirable about 88 Rising is that they didn't have to compromise their Asian identity. I think the key word is acceptance, because I feel like 88 Rising becoming something relevant in today's music industry, something that probably wouldn't have happened a while back because of the lack of diversity. I think that the celebration of diversity these days is what fueled or made the space for 88 Rising's rise into the international market success. Okay.
I mean, I get what you mean. It's diversity because, like, the acceptance of diversity of culture nowadays, 2015 and beyond, is what makes them pop.
Yeah,
I guess if you go any earlier, let's say 2008, 88 Rising wouldn't be accepted, right?
You're also missing two magic words here: the internet and memes. Because if you realize the major reason I feel the founder of 88 Rising hit such a huge jackpot is because Rich Brian was a meme. Yeah, and Filthy Frank, who later became Zuji, was a meme. We already had a huge fan base for different stuff, not music. But yeah, so that's how they realized, hey, there's an internet culture here. We can really use it. And also, look, Asian diversity, man. Like a whole side of the spectrum that the US doesn't really pay attention to now. You know what I mean? So that's marketing. That's great branding. That's realizing this is what we need. You know? We don't have that. I feel like, I think virality in Malaysia is not a marketing tool. Virality is a marketing tool. Memes aren't, right? Because one is...
It's all good, it's all good. Oh my god.
This is raw to the max. This is punk rock. Yeah, it's like, because memes are a marketing tool in a way in which people absorb information bite-sized now, and like very few artists can adopt that kind of persona in Malaysia, and very few successfully do so. Like, I can think of two people that do it really well. One is Takara Suiko, like with constant Q&As on Insta stories, but also, like, even more, if you want to go more corporate and less weird, like So I'm Jen, right? With her Instagram profile and sponsorships and how genuine and warm she comes off as.
People can relate to her personality.
Yeah, but she follows that internet wave, you know what I mean? Like, she doesn't... Being a meme doesn't mean you have to be a... Can I swear?
Yeah, sure, man.
Doesn't mean you have to be a shit post.
I think you know the recipe. Like, even you're not attempting to break the meme culture whatsoever, but I think you are... You just talk about the secret sauce, man.
Yeah.
That is how it is. That's why Rich Shiga and probably Joji Pink Guy and all that. Yeah. Like, the pre... Like, you need the audience before someone would even listen to you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can't... I would say my guess is if Pink Guy didn't exist, Joji wouldn't pop.
Yeah.
You know?
Agreed.
You can easily get that kind of genre of music on YouTube right now for free.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
And there's a whole lo-fi R&B thing going on as well that Joji really followed through. But even if he followed that whole... Because right now everyone likes lo-fi hip-hop, right? Everybody studies to that on YouTube now, apparently. So like, Joji is perfect. That music, his music is perfect. But even then, he wouldn't be as big as he is now if it wasn't for his Filthy Frank history. I think that's a given.
I guess it's not too late, dude. It's not too late for... I guess that is a secret sauce that you can follow.
Like, maybe.
Get attention. Attention is the number one ROI, I guess, right? You get attention, people will listen to you.
Yeah, but attention needs to come with quality.
Yeah.
Joji does not... I mean, you might not like Joji's music, right? But he does not make...
Shitty music.
Like, yeah, there's still consistency in production, even if that production is uninteresting to you, for example, right? So attention only works as much as you can follow through later with quality. And that's what matters the most. Yeah. Quality still matters, but you know, the thing is, there are too many people who are qualified.
Yeah.
What makes you strange and qualified? That's what matters.
So here on Hello Hello Kopi Kamilo podcast, we always talk about the persistency, consistency, and all that, right? People who are trying to achieve their dreams and all that. But when you think is the right time to quit, and when you think is the right time to try and stop trying, is there ever a time, or you just have to keep on going until you reach that mountaintop?
I think there's a. I'm not an expert in this, of course, since I'm only 26, and I don't know if I've sufficiently gauged what is a good endpoint based upon my past efforts in a lot of things. I feel that you have to first know yourself, because when you know yourself, that's when you realize what your weaknesses and your strengths are. If what you're feeling while pursuing your passion is like mental toxicity and like this destroying you and isn't allowing you to have other options in the future, you may have to quit. But I can't tell you that, right? Because I don't know you. If you feel like this is enough, you should quit, right? This is, of course, an ideal circumstance, because usually people have responsibilities. Like, I still have to put food on the table, sometimes they have families to take care of and whatnot, right? But if that isn't a problem, you should know your weaknesses and quit when it's too much. Because people think quitting is the end of one opportunity, right? But I feel like quitting is also a room for you to try more things, right? Quitting means more free time for a while. Sure, it's also more free time to be depressed, right? But it's more free time for you to explore other things that might make you happy. And that's what matters the most, right? Because all of this stems from my anxiety of living one life. If I have lived one single life where I try one thing and it doesn't work out, I'm gonna die regretting that, right? But if you're the kind of person who feels like effort is what makes your life worthwhile, and just doing one thing over and over again, then sure, right? But if you're not the kind of person, try as many things as you want, right? Try as many things as you want, quit while you're ahead, and if people don't like you for that, screw them, it's your life. When you grow old, you realize you have more than one kind of story to tell. And that's what is meaningful.
Yeah.
Right.
And that is a pure goal right there, dude. Yeah. And then because like we are bogged down by the idea of resumes and how trying to make it look nice. Or you have to stay for 2 years in this company so that you don't look like a shit pothead, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, people, we are influenced by our, like, the generation before us and the generation before. But things have, like, vibrating in a different way right now, you know? I guess, you know, the most important thing is to adapt.
Yeah. I feel it's because people think quitting means lack of discipline. It's not true, right? Like, you know, discipline is not the best value all the time, especially if you're disciplined into doing something wrong. So if you are not bogged down by the need to feed your family or whatever, right, you should do something that matters to you. Even then, right, I feel, even if, let's say, I have lived a different life where my life was harder than it is now. I mean, of course, I'm still constantly broke, right? But like, if I was more broke and I wasn't able to do anything substantial because I was always starving or have families to feed, like a lot of poor people are, you should still find time for yourself, because it matters a lot. Like life is not just about work, unless there is art. And I don't mean art in terms of you have to learn how to paint or learn musician or learn to be a musician. What makes you tick? You know, what makes you feel that you're happy to be human? It can be faith, right? It can be books. It can be your friends. Have that one moment, right? Never push yourself to the limit if the limit is just death. If the limit is just, oh, I have money now, right? But then I guess the thing that people forget to talk about is that along the way, you shouldn't hurt people. Because let's say if your passion is greed, if you're Jeff Bezos and you're like not allowing for laborers to, you know, take toilet breaks or whatever, then don't pursue your dreams, right? Don't hurt your people, right? Yeah. Don't hurt people along the way. But yeah, have something about yourself that ticks. I think there's one more thing, right? People feel that they have to follow a timeline in their lives a lot. Like, by 30, I need to be married. But, you know, by tomorrow you can die. So how do you want to live your life and mold yourself that way matters, right? You don't live your life in constant anxiety if you can afford it, but have something that makes you comfortable. So I'm at this.
Yeah, cool, bro. If you could have a cup of coffee with any dead musicians from the past, like any dead musician from the past, if you could have a cup of coffee with them and have certain conversations with them, who would it be and what kind of questions would you ask them, man? It has to be a dead musician.
It has to be a dead musician.
Yeah.
Bowie. Yeah. Bowie has been such a huge inspiration to me.
Wow.
Remember when I talked about androgyny and like, you know, breaking gender stereotypes and whatever? Yeah, David Bowie was one of my first exposures to that. Wearing makeup and costumes and strutting around like an enchantress, seductress from space, that kind of thing. That's so inspiring. But also because Bowie is very humble too. Like, and that's just a brilliant mix of a creative to me. Like, how on earth has someone explored the deep crevices of space in their mind? Another word for getting high. And like creating like random stuff in so many concepts and so many genres, because Bowie also has a metal album as well, right? And all that stuff. Be so nice. That's why I would love to have coffee with him.
Yeah.
David Bowie is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
What specific question do you have for him though?
When you created Ziggy Stardust, right? When you created Ziggy Stardust, if you created Ziggy Stardust now, what celebrity would be satirized? Like, would Ziggy Stardust be a SoundCloud rapper? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
SoundCloud rapper with a difficult personality? Or will he be like Ariana Grande? You know, what kind of persona? Because Ziggy Stardust was supposed to be a mockery of rock, right? Not a mockery, but basically like a personification of rock that David Bowie was put into, right? Like, he was boxed into that and he was just like, might as well just go it to the fullest. Embrace the glam, embrace the glitz. So what's the 2010s version of that? That's why I said, like, you know, would they be Migos? Like, that would be really cool. I want to see David Bowie do Ziggy Stardust in the current era. Would love to ask that question.
What would your advice be, bro, for the people who are going through what you went through with your law degree and all that, who are trying to actually partake into their creative journey but don't have the right courage, don't have the right path, or they can't see the future in a way, they can't pave their own way? What would you tell them? Should they stick to what they are doing or go for it, dive deep and just embrace the unknown?
Yeah.
How would you say, bro?
I feel there is a bare minimum that you have to push for first. I finished my degree, right? I passed. So I didn't decide to quit halfway throughout law degree, even though I started to be annoyed by it. So try and get that bare minimum, right? Do finish things, right? And then decide what I've done is bogus and then quit. So the most important thing is finishing things until you realize you can't do it anymore. But also finishing things so that you don't feel like you've wasted the past 4 years. Because really, if you want to start something new, there's no age too late, right? Like, you can be 40 and still be a musician, right? But yeah, sure, pay off that pension first, right? Fill that pension fund first. Buy pay your children to go to college. And then they decide to become a musician. Doesn't matter, right? There's no real timeline for that anymore, especially in the age of the internet where people are much more embracing in some parts as well, right? So, like, don't be scared. Find a support group. Find friends that can help you talk it out. But at the end of the day, you know your own strengths and weaknesses. You gotta push through while you can. But I feel what I did was, when I pushed through in that bare minimum context thing, when I was trying to pass my law degree, I still dabble in things I love. Always dabble. That's my advice. This is that slogan, that's the caption on your Instagram, okay? always dabble, because you never know what could be useful. Like, if you're free, try video design, you know, after your law homework, whatever. If you're free, talk to people who you would never talk to at all, right? Regardless whether that person is someone that you think is too out of your circle, or someone who is just like not in the same personality as you. Do it until you can't. Dabble is important. Always dabble.
Cool. All Alright, this is the moment where I flip the script and let you ask me any question that goes through your mind.
Oh, you mean I could have done that? Okay.
Yeah, any question, anything at all apart from the podcast. Yeah, apart from why do I start this podcast? Because it has been a common question that I've been asked. Anything, man, you can go as creative, as crazy as you want. Go for it, man. Anything you're curious about?
Do you think it's important to have meaning in life?
Oh yeah, that's a fucking good question, dude. Yes, it is, man. Mm. It is important because meaning gives you the push. Because without meaning, when you don't, some say that I'm an overthinker. Maybe some might have called you that as well, right? Because we give meaning into everything. Why do we make a left turn? Because so that we can save 2 minutes, and then because it's gonna rain, and then the sun is gonna shine better. Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. Meaning gives you motivation, and it's like a storytelling that you tell in your head. It gives you more excitement, sort of the illusion of a better storyline. You know, why do you do what you do? It's because of this. Without meaning, like, you do this because you need. You're just filling your time because your mom told you what to do, or because your dad expect you to do this, and then it gives you no sort of contentment in you. Mm. So meaning sort of fills in that void, I feel. Mm. That is a hard part, finding meaning in something that you do. Mm. Because once you found it, then it's easy. Then you are happy.
Yeah.
You know, you are blissed.
You agree that you have to find that meaning. Nobody can prescribe that meaning for you.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that's the difficult part, man. That is the like sort of pre-production of filming, you know? Why is the story, why does it go this way? And that is where people don't do it, though.
Yeah, people don't do research.
Yeah.
In making philosophical movies in their heads and real movies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and then when you ask them, why? You are such an overthinker. You don't... come on, man, don't overthink it. But the truth of the matter is they don't have meaning in their life, you know?
I feel a bit pretentious. Like, people who don't overthink don't have meaning.
I mean, they don't even think. They just do, though.
Right.
Okay, down to the last question, bro. How do you want people to remember Zim Ahmadi at the end of the day?
Oh, bias, girlfriend. Anyway, I want to be remembered as the person who's introduced to at least a community of people really cool things. Things that they would have never discovered if it wasn't for me. You know, I want to be that person who people are thankful for. It can be as small as introducing them to new music or new books, but also in terms of, you know, thinking about life, right? I don't want to leave an impact upon the world. I don't have to, right? But if those few people, if it's just my close loved ones or like, you know, people in the music circle, whatever, who feel thankful for that, I'm already thankful myself. Yeah, that's what I want people to remember me as. Also, I want people to remember me as Peminat Music Tegar, Budak Baru Belajar.
Alright, thank you so much for being part of Hello Hello Kopi Kamino Podcast.
Thank you, Milo. That was great.
It's gonna teach you the Milo's milkshake, man. Like,
oh, what's the Milo milkshake like?
One, and two, and three, and swear.
I got that. We have to work on that on the next episode.
My idea for Milo. No, Milo is a matahari.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Matahari.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see how the things connecting right now? I didn't even expect. Like, I didn't even know that this whole. Yeah, he's here. Suhail. Was that Suhail?
Yeah, Suhail. Yeah. So suddenly, like, you're in the world that you already are in.
Yeah, everyone in LA knows each other.
I guess, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
And how big is LA anyway? Pretty big?
Thank you so much for your support. Do us a favor and share this Spotify link or YouTube link that you're on to your closest friends. Who knows? There might be value for them as well. You know, great things in life are meant to be shared. You know, what is the meaning of life?
Hello, hello, Kopi Kamino podcast.
I guess you go, so never know. 42.